Welcome to the Omnipod, brought to you by Omni Magazine, the magazine of science and science fiction. Hey, everybody, I'm your host, Sam Phillips. Welcome to the show. Ooh, wasn't that music? All right, now, here are my guests, Kelly Caldwell, host, writer, researcher, and content creator with a focus on edutainment.
Yeah.
There you go.
You can leave it there.
There you go.
Yeah.
Berkeley Pickle, Canadian actor, voiceover artist, writer, and nerdy geek into gaming, circus arts, reading about time travel, science fiction, and currently writing a fantasy
animated series.
Thank you very much. That's the one part I was missing. And then, of course, my very good friend, James Martinez, hanging out for another show, two in a row, media ecologist, who served on many boards of advisors, and he's a nanotechnology expert.
Thank you.
Ooh, there you go. And then, the man of the hour, I'm so thrilled and honored to have with us on the phone, Andrew Basciago.
Correct.
Okay.
It's a good one.
There you go. So Andrew's the leading figure in the truth movement, and he's best known for revealing publicly his life's experiences as one of America's first-time space explorers and Mars visitors. Andy's a lawyer, writer, public speaker, media personality, and former chrononaut and 21st century visionary. He helped America achieve time travel. He also served as an early Mars explorer, as a team member in the CIA's Mars Jump Room program from 80 to 84. And he jumped from Mars and back via jump rooms in New York and El Segundo, California. Welcome to the Omnipod, Andy.
Hi, Sam. It's good to be with you tonight.
Thank you so much for doing our show. I'm so fascinated by your story. And you've been around a while talking about it. And I'd love for you to tell us more.
Well, it's a true story. It's a story that I felt ethically compelled to tell because, in fact, I'm one of the few survivors of the program. Most of the participants were mid-career professionals 40 and 50 years ago when the U.S. government achieved time travel in the year 1970. Almost 20 years ago, in 2000, I began investigating my experiences just to reality test them and prove them to myself. I'm a lawyer in Washington State, and I was under an ethical obligation to police my own psychiatric status. And I was a little bit derailed professionally for a time, and I began really scouring the country, calling people, consulting the internet, making site visits. And I proved my childhood participation in DARPA's Project Pegasus years ago. I had a meeting with a representative of the executive office of President George W. Bush in 2003 in Colorado. And I've already, in real time, in the public domain, discussed with high factual specificity my experiences, and then new information has come to light, creating inferences that there was no way possible for me to have known at the time that I factually described my experiences. I mean, they're almost too numerous to catalog. I mean, even just if I was to focus tonight on my trip to Gettysburg, where I was sent to witness the Gettysburg Address on November 19th of 1863, and then my return to Gettysburg 150 years later in 2013, just the information I developed during that fact-finding trip to Gettysburg proved that my experiences and my claims were real. So, I mean, really, we're so far behind on this. We're 50 years behind in adopting Tesla teleportation, the teleportation we achieved 48 years ago. Well, actually, we reduced it to practice at least 50 years ago because 1968 was the year that I first remember teleporting. I may have teleported earlier, not as a six-year-old, but as a four-year-old in 1966. But I remember teleporting in 1968. Okay, that's 50 years ago. And here we are debating whether it happened, and we haven't even modernized our society in 2.5 generations so that we, for example, we could have been teleporting goods by now. And, you know, we're still locked in a dispute as to whether or not these claims are true or not, but we should have implemented these technologies a half century ago.
Andy, so I'm sitting here with Sam, and this is going to be for Omni, and we talked a little bit prior before we went on the air about your experiences and your office, you running for president. Tell everybody what you have planned to do and what's next for you in terms of, are you coming out with a book? Are you going to go on speaking engagements? What do you intend to do?
Well, I ran for president in 2016 under an agenda stated in my 100 proposals, which was a call for truth, reform, and innovation. It was really the only substantial platform offered by a serious candidate. I did so as the first major figure in the truth movement to run for president. My 100 proposals were called by pundits awesome, brilliant, unprecedented, mind-blowing, genius in print, and a life experience to read. I was interviewed on television by the BBC, but I was blocked out by the major television networks that control the discourse that by which we select our president and which allowed essentially the U.S. military to install Donald Trump as president.
Well, I don't think it's any accident that he keeps putting generals in every position, mm-hmm. militarizing the government.
Right. Meanwhile, there were covert directed energy attacks on me after I called for slashing defense spending by 50% and urging the U.S. military, my 100 proposals, to dedicate at least 25% of their budget to peacekeeping and natural disaster relief and food distribution and other pro-social purposes. I really suffered greatly for running in 2016, which involved basically putting myself in the line of fire. And in the same way that the U.S. Army facilitated the assassination of Dr. King in concert with the Memphis Police Department, I don't want to go into it tonight, but I have at length described the assassination plot that was launched against me by the U.S. Army during the 2016 campaign. I'm currently convalescing from the damage that was done to my cardiopulmonary cortex and my visual cortex by that multi-pronged, essentially 10-year effort by the Army. I actually had a heart attack gun fired at me in a hotel room by a campaign aide who was either working with them or under some form of mind control. So I don't want to go into the details of it beyond that, except to say that the election was a year and a half ago. I was injured. Thank God I survived. I'm convalescing. It's my intent right now to finish my books about my service in DARPA's Project Pegasus and the CIA's Mars Jump Room program, because if I don't put down a history of what we achieved in those programs, I'm not sure that anybody else will. I would note that recently NASA astronaut Dr. Ken Johnston came forward to acknowledge that we were on Mars together and that he was a participant in the Jump Room program. I would also like to state that, and just honor the memory of the late William Whitecrow, who died on February 16th, that before his death, Whitecrow and I gave several interviews, one of them with Major General Mark Musick and Douglas Wellman, the author of a recent book about Howard Hughes entitled Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, in the early half of the 1980s in being the technical director and basically the technical genius behind the Mars Jump Room program. We've been bringing that information forward, but I have to write the memoirs just so that we have a true account of what those of us who served in those programs experienced. experienced basically the emergence of 8 different forms of time travel and ultimately the development of a space elevator that was a form of quantum access that gave us a form of visitation of Mars. So, you know, I'm telling a true story. It's not critical that I, among all Americans, become president, but should I be blessed enough to regain my full health enough to run for president and serve as president, I will be a candidate in 2020, and if not then, in 2024. Mr. Trump was a candidate who made entirely inappropriate comments as a candidate, and he was still elected. And that represents, I think, the degree to which we've lost our way as a country. The government is not telling the truth to the people. There has been a overt usurpation of the presidency by what Alfred Weber calls the chronarchy, basically the faction within the government that used time travel to identify future events and persons of interest. I was one of those individuals. We are what Robert Kennedy stated we were on the last day of his life, a great people, a generous people, a compassionate people. And he was talking about the American people, not just not necessarily our government. And those people deserve to be told the truth by those who are seeking the highest office in the land. And that's what I've been bringing. The fact that U.S. astronauts were on Mars in 1964. I made about 40 trips to Mars via jump room between 1981 and 1984. When we were there, according to William Whitecrow, who was also there, so we've now got 9 Americans from disparate backgrounds, different walks of life, who didn't know each other when this all began, who have verified their involvement in the jump room program.
Were they also young kids like you at the time, Andy?
Well, the youngest, I was a young child time traveling in Project Pegasus, but then in the Mars program, we were basically in our late teens and early 20s. The youngest person I know of to go there was William Stillings, who was 14 when we first went in summer of 1981 after being, Brett Stillings was born the year that you were born, which was 1966.
Yeah.
And so he was 14 in summer of 1981. He would turn 15 that December. I was 19 when I first went, and then I stopped going when I was 22. So we were half the age of Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. And we didn't just go to a moon orbiting this planet. We went all of the millions of miles to the planet that every 2 years comes closest to Earth, but nonetheless is way out there compared to the moon. You know, at half the age, with no guarantee that we were coming home. We were always concerned that the jump room would fail. There was hardly any food there, hardly any water. There were several races of humanoids. There were several forms of predators that if we got anywhere near, we were going to end up becoming lunch. It was a scary place to be. And yet I'm very proud of my 8 colleagues who have come forward. We've now lost Whitecrow, but, you know, he gave some critical interviews and did some critical conference presentations before his death at age 63 on the 16th of February. I'm not the only one sharing this information. I may be the only one to take it into a presidential campaign context. But this needs to be known. I mean, the people have a right to know the true state of the technical development on our planet, and they have also have, I think, a right under the common heritage of humanity to know the true nature of the cosmos we inhabit. And that's one in which the planet that comes closest to our planet every 2 years, like our planet, is inhabited. Mars is not teeming with life in the way that Earth is. It has a very fragile civilization and ecosystem. But it does have a planetary civilization and ecosystem. It's fascinating. It's one that we can learn a lot from. If we learn the lessons of what happened to Mars, we may be able to save this planet. If we utilize the technologies that these programs develop, we may have a chance to save this planet, most especially from a coming global superstorm type global cataclysm as described by Art Bell and Whitley Strieber. And that's why I'm speaking out. I'm speaking out of a sense of dire ethical urgency and not grandstanding. I wanted to live an ordinary life. You know, I wanted to become a lawyer and a journalist. But just the unusual nature of what I experienced in childhood and in my college years at UCLA compelled me to become a public figure and you know, really take this to the edge. And that was to share the truth as a presidential candidate and end up being targeted as a result. I'm going to move forward. I'm going to, recuperate and convalesce and get stronger and heal what they damaged and take this campaign forward because our planetary survival depends on it.
Hey, Andy, what did your dad do back when you were young that indoctrinated you into that program?
Well, when I was serving in Pegasus from 1968 to 72, 73 time frame, my dad was a special projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company publicly, but privately he was essentially the chief technical consultant between Parsons, which is really the world's leading engineering company, arguably competing with Bechtel for that distinction, and the CIA on the theory and practice of Tesla teleportation. He had a familiarity with teleportation because when he was serving at the Thomas A. Edison Research Laboratory in West Orange, New Jersey, as an engineer, with individuals like J.B. Johnson, the discoverer of white noise, two desks over from him, from 1956 to 64, the federal government asked him to repeat Nikola Tesla's teleportation experiments. And he basically learned the theory and the science of Tesla teleportation. And he began time traveling sometime in the mid-60s. I was brought in because he was approached by the federal government that I had to be brought in because we had a team in the year 2045, posted 100 years after the end of World War II and the advent of the atomic age. And they had advised my dad that my destiny was such that I had to be involved. I would write the book, I would become a public figure, a public servant, and bring these technologies forward. So my dad was sort of, you know, allowing us to have a high adventurous father and son by serving in the project. He was mentoring me in the technologies. I think to some extent he was using me to cultivate a whistleblower on a multi-generational basis because he would be killed if he revealed what we were achieving. He was inculcating me with a highly technical and specific knowledge of the technologies that allowed me to take some of the secrets of this public. So, for example, I once asked my dad, you know, Dad, how is the project creating these time-space holograms with the devices called chronovisors? And he said, we're putting an EM signal through an eight-sided bismuth crystal. And after I had stated that on multiple interviews and multiple public talks that I've given over the years, over the last 20 years, somebody approached me and said, you know, I found a reference to your dad's work with bismuth crystals stated as the first prior work in the legendary Japanese physicist Asaki's 1967 patent involving, guess what? Eight-sided bismuth crystals. So my dad was sort of giving me enough detail, knowing that I had an eidetic memory that was fairly good, so that I would take the data forward and be able to prove what we did and be able to maybe even have some of the information if the government lost it. And that's, in fact, what's happened. So, and there's multiple examples of that. You know, I described how, for example, my dad's colleague, Dr. Sterling Colgate, the president and dean of physics at the New Mexico Institute of Science and Technology in the spring of 1972, with my father present at the lab in East Hanover, New Jersey, sent me to Gettysburg on November 19th of 1863 via a technique that he had pioneered called plasma confinement. Well, that would just be a science fiction fantasy if I didn't prove that Sterling Colgate was connected to such a technology. So I went to his university, the New Mexico Institute of Science and Technology, in Socorro, New Mexico. I consulted Joy Thompson, the librarian of their research library. She allowed me to access their special collections. I found the clip file with photographs and newspaper clippings of Dr. Sterling Colgate, and I found a newspaper clipping stamped with 1972 postmark, you know, with a date mark, about how he was going to be giving a public lecture about his advances in a new technology called plasma confinement. That's just one of dozens, perhaps even hundreds of proofs of that specificity that I've offered. And yet there still is at least a debate that some would entertain that I may not be telling the truth. It's ridiculous at this point. I mean, you know, I've given information that's as high quality as the video footage that's offered to establish that somebody robbed a bank. So that's what's happened, and I just have to, you know, validate that. I have to just come out and say that's my position, as I've already proved my case. I've gained some notoriety as a public figure, maybe let's say about the 1% level on Google. I received about 20,000 votes as a presidential candidate, but this is growing, and, you know, every interview helps, including this, and, you know, when we're older and our children will be living in a world in which the distance problem will be solved. I mean, when I visited 2045, it was a world in which you could go into an elevator-like device in a building in one city and come out into a hallway of another building in another city. So teleportation is going to be standardized. It's going to be made safe. Whatever it did to the metabolic functioning of myself and the kids who served with me will be addressed through supplementation or the elimination of frequency problems. And it's that kind of world. It's a world in which you can live out in the boonies somewhere and teleport to work.
Well, that will save on gas and emissions, right?
Yeah. And do so without consuming fossil fuels that are driving the climate crisis. I mean, we're going to be living in a world in which high school kids in California are going to be doing their senior prom in Paris and then teleporting back home and sleeping in their own beds that night. I mean, we're really going to be living in a world that's almost hard to comprehend. We will solve the distance problem.
Andy, do you think that they're currently doing this now?
I beg your pardon?
Do you think that they're currently continuing to experiment now as we speak?
Well, I and my peers in the program were supposed to go on to the Naval Academy, according to the defense attaché to the program, Donald Rumsfeld, to use our naval rank and service as a pretext for involving us in future project activities. Rumsfeld shared that in a bar with my dad in about 1971 time frame. So, and also, we were accidentally displaced one time, arriving in Santa Fe from New Jersey via teleportation in 1991 one morning rather than 1971. So I know the project was up and running by 91. And if we look at Rumsfeld's statement with my expected college graduation in the 1983-84 time frame, which was supposed to have been from the Naval Academy, I have the profound suspicion that the program simply continued. The reason that we were separated from the program, as it was explained to us when we left in 72-73, was that that's what they always do so that one person doesn't learn too much about these classified defense projects. We were simply dismissed from the project so we wouldn't learn too much. But the project seemed to be continuing. So, yes, I think it exists today.
Hey, Andy, I'm going to take a quick break here on the Omnipod. Will you hang out with us and stay on the show?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Because we all have questions for you. So we'll be right back. You're listening to the Omnipod, brought to you by Omni Magazine, the magazine of science and science fiction. I'm your host, Sam Phillips, with Kelly Caldwell, Berkeley Pickle, James Martinez, and our guest, Andrew Basciago. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Omnipod, brought to you by Omni Magazine, the magazine of science and science fiction. Follow us on Facebook.com/RealOmni, Twitter.com/OmniMagazine, and OmniMagazine.com. Check out our website. I'm your host, Sam Phillips, with Kelly Caldwell, Berkeley Pickle.
Hello.
James Martinez. And Andrew Basiago. I want to say Basiago, Andy.
Don't. You have it pretty close.
Basiago. Basiago?
Yeah, like Chicago.
Okay, that's easy. Now if I have a correlation of a Chicago, Basiago.
Done.
All right, so my friends, my guests, my co-hosts here have a million questions for you. So I'm going to roll to Kelly first.
Yeah, so many questions. Hi, nice to meet you, by the way, Andy.
Hi, Kelly.
So I have a question. We've been told and you've said that you're the leader or the most known figure in the truth movement. What else does that represent other than kind of the stories and the experiences that you're giving to us here today? What are the other kind of pieces to the truth movement?
Are you asking me what are the other pieces of my truth platform as president?
Well, I'd love to hear about that, too. But I was kind of under the assumption, maybe wrongly, that the truth movement kind of had some other bigger pieces to it, like maybe it seems like it's kind of hinged on a distrust with what the government puts out to the public. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I think like all mass movements and political movements, it's been infiltrated by government operatives. You know, for example, I hate to do this segue. It might be unfair, but one of the individuals I met when I was in training for the Jump Room program in summer of 1980, who was then studying in another CIA seminar at College of the Siskiyous, was Stephen Greer. Okay, so I'm sure that to some extent there are gatekeepers. I came forward simply based on my own initiative. And in fact, I've had such few discussions with government people since coming forward with this information that it's laughable. I mean, I should have been interviewed already by the CIA just based on what I know. I should have had representatives of leading physicists and physics departments around the country call me on the phone because I have classified information in some instances about how to build specific time machines. I don't have all of the information, and I don't have maybe enough to build one from scratch.
Well, and that's another question I had for you, Andy, is that there's all sorts of stuff on the internet about you, as I'm sure you know. And one of the things that I had read is that you actually have some of the mathematical proofs for some of these things that you experienced. Is that true?
Are you saying that I don't have proof?
Oh, no, I'm wondering if you do. I read that on the internet about you, and I happen to love me a good proof.
Sure. I mean, I have the statement by Jean Maria Rigo that I was involved in the quantum access, an ethicist for the Intel community. I have the admission by Dr. Harold Agnew that there was a teleportation project. I have the admission by Joe Connison, the Parsons engineer who worked with my father and I met in Albuquerque many times when I was on the project, who said, when I told him I was going to be writing a book and trying to have a movie made about my experiences involving the teleporters and the chronovisors and so forth, said a book, a movie, nobody on the outside knows about that stuff. I brought forward fellow teleportees and fellow Mars visitors. Now, when somebody testifies in a court of law as to what they saw or what they did, it's not hearsay. The American law of evidence treats it as direct evidence. So in providing direct evidence of my experience, I've not only provided hundreds of facts of my own experience that went on for years, but I have brought forward other witnesses and other participants. For example, let's just isolate the issue of teleportation, since that sort of led my campaign, because that was the fundamental technical application that they had developed that I was doing and the other participants in Project Pegasus were doing. I brought forward a fellow teleportee publicly, my childhood classmate and fellow churchgoer, Mark DePrimo. I brought forward the actor Eden Tudor, who described teleporting between Pasadena, California, and Langley, Virginia, which was the Parsons CIA nexus. I brought forward William Whitecrow, who on April 29th of 2016 stated that he was my martial arts instructor when I was time traveling for DARPA, that we crossed paths on Mars when he was an Army guard on Mars and I was one of the civilian jumpers, and then he endorsed me for president. This is a career Army officer.
Right.
So I brought forward the value of the testimony of others. I brought forward really deeply embedded factual proofs in which later data, both published and unpublished, was offered that showed the profound inferences offered by my data. For example, I was describing how when they were sending me to Ford's Theater to see who shot Mr. Lincoln, every time I would go up to their balcony seating, they weren't there. And then somebody found evidence that the Lincolns were late for the theater that night. You know, I mentioned finding the newspaper clipping linking Dr. Sterling Colgate, president of New Mexico Tech, to a new science called plasma confinement, to finding the reference to the eight-sided bismuth crystal and a reference to my own father, who I've described as a project principal, in a U.S. patent. So if anybody's alleging that I haven't offered evidence, of course, is offered under a certain standard of proof, and proof is determined by the fact finder, the judge or the jury, whether proof has occurred. I think what people are talking about is evidence. Have I offered substantial evidence, material evidence of my claims? And yes, I have. I've offered hundreds of pieces of substantial evidence, some of it documentary. When we analyzed the picture of me at Gettysburg in 1863, we blew up the head of that child who was dressed in a manner that I described, how he was wearing a hodgepodge of clothing and how it was me and how I was fading from view and going back to East Hanover, New Jersey in 1972 when the picture was being taken. Well, when we photo-analyzed my head and face in that picture, we found evidence that the picture captured my right eye socket and the left side of my teeth. Well, wait a minute. Marie Curie, the Polish chemist whose discovery of radium allowed for the development of X-ray, would not even be born for 4 years in 1867. So there's no way that even though Civil War photographs were creating blurred images of human beings, that they were X-raying human beings standing still, which is how I'm depicted in that photograph. What I'm saying is the Josephine Cobb image of itself, which is now widely known as showing me at Gettysburg as a time traveler from the future, which is what it shows, which is what my father for this of the CIA confirmed to me it showed back in the early 70s. Upon photo analysis, after photo analysts went to the National Archives and the Library of Congress and found it was the only classified Civil War photograph in possession of the United States government, it was then analyzed and found to show an X-ray of my body. Well, why would that have occurred? Because I was fading from view. So my point there is I've even offered a photographic analysis showing myself time traveling, showing myself basically evanescing, as I've called it. When the plasma confinement effect would wear off, you'd have a massive kundalini sensation, and you would just find yourself back in the chamber of the plasma confinement device, back in the present. So that was beginning while the photographer was setting up, and I knew that because I looked over at him, and he actually looked at me from behind his photographer's canopy. So, you know, firsthand account backed up by other participants' testimony offered voluntarily and without any ulterior motive or purpose of evasion, photographic evidence, documentary evidence linking certain researchers to certain institutions to certain technical processes. Man, I've done it. I'm proud of what I've accomplished here. I think I've cobbled together as many forms of proof about the existence of the time travel program Project Pegasus as those 80 Roswell crash witnesses that Jim Mars used to talk about have offered to establish that extraterrestrials crashed in Roswell, New Mexico on July 7th of 1947. Yes, I've proven my case with evidence.
I believe you, dude.
Yeah. And sorry, to be clear, I wasn't that wasn't a challenge in any way. There's just like amazing things written about you on the internet that I'm like, if that's true, that's amazing. So somewhere, someone had attributed mathematical genius to you, and I was like, tell me all the things. It was not. But anyway,
well, some of I must say that some of my better answers in interviews have sometimes had a mathematical syllogism to them. I was trained in advanced math at UCLA. A critical point here is that Enrico Fermi knew that there was a time-space continuum. That, for example, when you fire a pistol, it doesn't just exist as burnt gunpowder, but you can change your frame of reference and go back and see the pistol being fired. So there's history as we remember it, and then there's history as it exists that you can go and visit. That's a fundamental question. Is there a so-called time-space continuum? I'm here to say that not only is there a time-space continuum, but I've been moved around inside of it.
So, Andy, speaking about the time-space continuum, you speak a lot about the way they've used time travel to observe the past and the future. Is it possible to make changes on these trips? Can you change something in the past? Has our reality been altered in some way that we're unaware of?
Well, that's a semantic and a logical dilemma. You can go to the past or the future and affect events, but let's just take the past. When you go to the past and strive to change something, you're in the past's present. So rather than changing what occurred then, you create it. So people say, well, could you have gone and shot Mr. Lincoln when you went to see him speak at Gettysburg? Yes, I could have, theoretically, hypothetically, but I didn't. And so that didn't get embedded in the time-space continuum. So the answer is semantic. You cannot go back and change the past, because if from the perspective of the future you're going to do something there to try to change an outcome or a condition, you did.
You will have already have going to have been done that.
Right, yeah.
Well, actually, you haven't already done so, except from the perspective of the past.
So for both time travel and teleportation, what use has the U.S. government been putting them to, if they've been keeping them from being implemented more widely? Are they using them themselves, or?
Well, Berkeley, this is really a great question, and in fact, it's one of the reasons I've been speaking out. Because you cannot change the past or future based on prior knowledge of it and a desire to actually engineer it, and also because not all time travel involves somebody traveling to the past or future. So I introduced the term quantum access to describe either traveling to a past or future event via time travel technology, or gathering information about a past or future event via some form of time travel technology that does not involve sending a person there, basically creating a remote image of that past or future person, event, or condition. So quantum access is really the overarching purpose of the U.S. time-space program, not time travel per se. When I was serving on Project Pegasus under DARPA as a kid, I read a mimeographed DARPA technical paper that was entitled Remote Sensing in Time. That was really the programmatic purpose of Pegasus, was not necessarily to move people around in time, but just gather better information about past or future events to enable the government to involve itself in better contingency planning for present and future events. Now, one of the reasons I'm speaking out is in that process of using quantum access, look at, you know, Buzzy Krongard's shorting airline stocks the day before or the weeks before of United and American Airlines stock shortly before 9/11, if you want an example of somebody within the intelligence community who had prior knowledge of the event as a result of quantum access and made a strategically smart investment decision as a result. That has happened. So the process of quantum access has been corrupted by financial privateering. So while there were noble purposes in establishing Project Pegasus, privateering by private forces, I wouldn't doubt it if some of these technologies are now in the possession of the Carlyle Group and the Rumsfeld, Bush, Cheney, sort of Halliburton faction. And then when you look at the lack of sincerity of the public officials to not come forward and say, look, something happened, and that is we secretly developed time travel, and those of us who have served, I mean, any of the recent presidents could have given this press conference to Steve Croft on 60 Minutes.
I can imagine it would be pretty hard to come forward that with that information. You say that when you visited the future in about 30 years from now, that we were regularly using teleportation. That seems particularly incredible. People hardly trust self-driving cars now. It's a pretty big leap in trust for people to start trusting teleportation.
Since we developed the technology 50 years ago, and hopefully that generation that included my father guaranteed the safekeeping and the schematics and directions for the technology and so forth, that it even if the program is mothballed, hopefully the technology has still been preserved. And there's no reason why it couldn't be implemented. What I was describing was, by 30 years from now, it's not just a matter of lunging through vortal tunnels in time-space as we were. The teleportees tomorrow will be ensconced in Kevlar devices. They'll be ensconced in car-like devices that will mimic the interior of commercial passenger planes. I call them VORTs, for Vehicles of Recumbent Teleportation. So they won't be exposed to the raw energies of these VORT tunnels that we were leaping through and to some extent being medically compromised by. And I'm just describing that it's gotten so advanced by 2045 that, you know, there's really no longer any distance problem. There's an international teleportation management system as sophisticated as today's telephone system. How often do we get on a conference or party line anymore, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, we've really been separating our phone calls, even on the international and level and the local level and so forth. So we
do the Amazon same thing can't wait to revolutionize their delivery process.
Say that again.
I bet Amazon can't wait to revolutionize their delivery process.
We will teleport your big box straight to your house.
Please don't give them more ideas.
Well, the internet merchandisers will do really great in that era because their goods will be teleported and being thrown through vortal tunnels in common nexuses rather than on some, you know, out there on some airplane or in some 22-wheeler where they may, you know, be in an accident and get lost. So the internet merchandisers are really going to prosper as a result of the implementation of teleportation for shipping. It's going to make their shipping costs a lot lower and hence their profits a lot higher.
Andy, why do you think that the government has gone out of their way to bury teleportation, like not allow it to prosper or the public to be aware of it or to partake in it? Why are they keeping it a secret?
That's a very difficult question. It's possible that it was so secret that it became over compartmentalized and the government really doesn't understand what it did. Clearly, sources that I spoke to in the intelligence community when I came forward did know that the project existed and who I was, you know, that it involved time travel and my father and I were in it and that was telling the truth. I think so. So generally, if you look at it from sort of like a Brookings kind of perspective, clearly the teleportation technology in and of itself as a transport technology was viewed as disruptive. So we have that whole debate that was recapitulated during the spotted owl controversy in Oregon, the Old Grove Forest controversy, of whether you have a right or not to your grandfather's job and whether it hurts society to introduce superior technologies. In fact, when you do more with less energy, material, and time, you help society. That's been shown again and again. You create more jobs, you create more prosperity, you create more real wealth. Okay, so there's the kind of the disruptive technology argument tied to the notion that, oh, you're going to put people out of job, put people out of work, you know, what's going to happen to the airline industry, et cetera.
And, of course, it must be difficult to regulate.
Right. In fact, the teleportation revolution, by being a superior transport technology, will create more prosperity. Imagine any one of us who could go and, let's say, as writers and travel every day from L.A. to Paris to sit down and write with a French writing partner. I mean, come on. When you solve the distance problem, there's going to be all kinds of – that's going to catalyze prosperity in a way that we can't even imagine. Now, that's one form of disruption that they've been concerned about, is the immediate economic disruption of teleportation as a transport technology. There's obviously the more complicated and sort of difficult question of how and on what basis do you introduce time travel per se, or even just quantum access. My position is that if we were to involve mass people in mass time travel on mass timelines, it could potentially lead to mass social chaos. So it's a kind of a simple, problem of, well, how is this going to totally transform the face of society as transport? And then how do we manage time travel?
Andy, you are fantastic. And I believe every word that you're saying. And I'm really thrilled that you've shared your story with the Omnipod and with my friend James, who you know very well, and with Kelly and with Berkeley and myself. Our show has come to a conclusion, but I would love for you to plug your Facebook page, any way that people can reach you, email, any way.
Well, the best source for the discourse I'm maintaining on the time travel cover-up is at Project Pegasus, and I would urge anybody to contact me via Facebook private message. I am having problems with my vision, so I'm doing my best. I'm going to be bringing out several books, including a sprawling Q&A on time travel technology. So a lot of the questions that have been asked for a number of years at Project Pegasus will be given ample answers in book form soon. But that's probably the best way to stay on top of this sort of quiet revolution of knowledge about time travel, and to follow my work and to communicate with me.
Great. That's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Andy. We got to do it again, buddy. Next time you come to LA, we got to hang out.
I'd love to, Sam.
I'll take you out. I'll take you for a nice meal, and we can talk more time travel.
I'm on. I mean, we're on.
Okay, good. And we'll even bring your buddy James.
Nah, leave him out of it.
No, I love James. Are you kidding? All right. Thank you so much, Andy. I'm going to let you go. Have a great night, buddy.
Thank you.
And thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, so plug really quick, because not everybody had a lot to say this show. James, actually, Kelly, you go first.
Okay,
where can people find you?
You can find me on all the socials at Kelly K. Caldwell. That's kind of it.
JamesMartinezMedia.net.
I'm Berk Pick, BERKPICK, on all of the social media. Check out my YouTube.
And then I'm The Single Life on Twitter, Sam's Pajama Party on Instagram, and follow the Omnipod, Facebook.com, Real Omni, Twitter.com, Omni Magazine, and check out our site, omnimagazine.com. Thank you for hanging out with us for the Omnipod, and I'll catch you on the next one.